Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The presidential race has already reached historic spending levels. In March, it blew past the $1 billion mark. That's according to the Center for Public Integrity. We are also seeing record-breaking spending at the state level. Powerful interest groups in California have spent $24 million on legislative races. This is according to the LA Times. And millions more will be spent in the coming days. In some cases, politicians don't even know they're being featured in commercials. We'll talk about that later in the show. Money is also pouring into local elections. 48 Hills, the San Francisco Chronicle, and the San Francisco Examiner all report that Facebook, Google, Airbnb, PG&E, big landlords and developers have poured over $1 million into the San Francisco election. 48 Hills' Tim Redmond says he's never seen an ocean of big money in this kind of election. So how are reporters following the money? We will also talk about voting. According to KCRA, it's a station out of Sacramento, there was one exit poll of independent vote-by-mail voters, and it shows that 40% wanted to vote for a Democratic presidential candidate, but only 15% requested a Democratic ballot. So this means that a lot of voters, those who are no party preference, are not voting for a Democrat because they didn't have the information that they had to request the ballot. So where is media coverage about this? Today we're joined by Joe Fitzgerald Rodriguez, a political columnist for the San Francisco Examiner's On Guard. He has been writing about all of these issues. In fact, Joe just wrote a ballot about the 1,400 ballots that were incorrectly mailed to San Francisco voters right before the election. Hi, Joe. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first off, as we always do on our media roundtables, we start off on a positive note and talk about news out there that was well reported this week. So what did you see this week that you thought was done well?
I saw this week from a little earlier in the month was in San Francisco Magazine, Joe Eskenazi's The Power and the Story. Really amazing background on Willie Brown, former assemblyman, former speaker, former mayor of San Francisco. And it's a very simple story about how a former power broker, head of a very, very strong Irish group, the Residential Builders Association in San Francisco, and Willie are having a spat over a house. All they're doing is arguing about what are we going to do with this house? And in this comes tumbling out all this information about Willie Brown's power structure, how he can leverage permits for multi-million dollar developments, how he can wrestle power for multi-billion dollar corporations with a single phone call. And the power of Willie, when you slide him $50,000 as your attorney, is to get the man who is most connected to every single person in San Francisco. And it all comes tumbling out from a disagreement over a house in Oakland, which I think is fascinating. And Joe Eskenazi, this artful writer, he pulls the threads apart, this amazing tapestry of power that everyone always suspects is there. Everyone always suspects is happening. Oh, Willie, he's a fixer. Oh, Willie, you know what he does. But do you really know what he does? And what he really does is shown in this story, The Power in the Story. And it's fascinating to actually see and hear how Willie is able to craft power for people who for giant corporations or developers or whoever want to leverage something in San Francisco.
Okay, so this would take a whole show, but quickly, for people who really want to know, can you describe it? How is he able to do this? I mean, there's a photo of Willie Brown with Mayor Ed Lee on this piece, and it says Willie Brown with one of the high-ranking officials on his speed dial.
So Willie Brown is able to do this because as mayor, he gave hundreds of people jobs. It was a patronage system covered really well by former Examiner reporters and then Chronicle reporters Chuck Finney and Lance Williams. Chuck, who now works as a spokesperson and lobbyist, and Lance, who works with the Center of Investigative Reporting now. But basically, Willie was mayor. Willie gave people jobs. They owe him. So now that he's no longer a mayor, everyone owes Willie. Everyone is in his network of power. And so he can ask them for favors. And that comes with a price.
And San Francisco Magazine has a lot of good political stories like this, right? I mean, they usually have fashion and food on their cover.
Right.
But inside the magazine, they usually have at least one in-depth political piece.
Absolutely. I have a lot of respect for their hustle. They have usually once a month something that really talks about someone in power, something that really unravels a situation that we all saw on the surface reported in either the Examiner or the Chronicle, that really they could pull the threads apart and you could really see the background of it.
And a couple years ago, they had another piece, Willie Brown finally makes it official. He's a lobbyist. San Francisco Magazine writes, since leaving office, critics have accused Willie Brown of trading on his law license to avoid disclosing his clients, which have included soda companies opposed to a tax in Richmond, PG&E, and developers. At the same time, he's writing a column for the San Francisco Chronicle.
Which, you know, and in this, the power in the story, Joe Eskenazi kind of posits that this Chronicle column that Willie gets to write allows him to bolster his image, show what a power broker he is, show how connected he is. It's basically free advertising for all of Willie's power broking, which is amazing. And the funniest part, my favorite part of all of this with the Chronicle column, is that when you look at Willie Brown's ethics filings as a lobbyist for 2014, the photo he uses is his photo from the Chronicle taken by a Chronicle photographer.
All right. So kudos to Joe Eskenazi at San Francisco Magazine for this piece, The Power and the Story. And we'll put a link at yourcallradio.org. Joe, since you are a columnist for the San Francisco Examiner, what are your thoughts about how San Francisco reporters are covering stories like this about the power players in this city?
Well, hey, I mean, I respect all my colleagues at the Chronicle and at the differing outlets, but the truth of the matter is that the press office in City Hall used to have 20 or so reporters in there every day. Now there's about four in there on a Tuesday when the board meets and two in there full-time for the rest of the week. KCBS's office that used to be home to Barbara Taylor, the epic Barbara Taylor, is now sits empty and has sat empty for months. There's just no one there, and so we're all scrambling to get as many of these stories about power players as we can to bring all this out into the sunshine. But there's only so much four people regularly reporting about City Hall insider politics can really do.
And we need it so much now because so much money is exchanging hands and the city is changing so drastically. So as a reporter with the Examiner and a columnist, how do you decide who to keep tabs on and where to put your focus?
Personally, I like to go where people aren't. A lot of people will follow the scrum, will follow like these larger stories that everyone will jump on all together simultaneously. And that can be useful too, you know, when you talk about the mayor, when you talk about state legislators. But I like to find myself in, for instance, like where I covered in my last column and what we're going to talk about today with the Democratic County Central Committee, which is so obscure. I mean, I just said that and like two-thirds of your listeners just glazed over. They don't know what I'm talking about.
Right.
But that's why it's so important, because no one knows. And you want to bring sunlight to the little dark corners that no one else is at.
Okay, well, if you're a registered voter, you are being inundated with flyers. I have never before received so many flyers during a primary season. Mm-hmm. And they are all so confusing because with this DCCC race, the Democratic Central County Committee.
County Central Committee.
There's just 15 faces on the flyer and you know nothing about these people.
Oh, sure.
There's no description of what this is or why this race is important. So tell us about, first off, the DCCC and what it does.
Sure. On a very basic level, a DCCC in any county is just the local Democratic Party. In anywhere else but San Francisco, you go to San Rafael or wherever, where the Alameda County, it's just a really simple Democratic Party board that does endorsements. We endorse Scott Wiener for Senate. We endorse Ed Lee for mayor. And it's just a way of showing local Democrats this is how the Democratic Party stands. They take stances. That's really what they do. And then they raise money. They raise money to register new Democrats. It's actually a really simple thing. Their job is to get as many Democrats in the voter rolls as possible. That's their main job, that and endorsements. And in San Francisco, though, because politics are like It's like a shark tank here. and as many have noted, actually prepares people well for federal and state offices. Because it's a shark tank here, all of a sudden it becomes a political battleground. And it actually, the DCCC is a place where many future supervisors begin their political careers, or many people who will run for higher office will get their start, get their feet wet.
All right. So talk a little bit about what it takes to report on the money flowing into this race. As I said earlier, Tim Redmond, who's a longtime reporter in San Francisco, says he's never seen an ocean of big money in this kind of election.
Yeah, so let me set the context for people who have never, who are just hearing about this body now, this DCCC as it's called. You know, in past years, the last election for this body was in 2012. The total amount of money raised was about $500,000, which even then was a lot for what it was. But because the DCCC, this kind of 30-member body, has kind of become a battleground, like a proxy battleground for the different factions on the city's board of supervisors, between the moderates and the progressives, moderates who tend to be favor businesses more, and the progressives who are a little more grassroots, I would argue, they're coming to a head at the DCCC because they want to control the endorsements that will help the next class of supervisors be elected, who may even help get the next mayor be elected. Now, there is some, like, so in order to report on the money, it's a fun little shell game of money. So let me give you an example. I think this is fun. So I have my laptop out. I'm looking at this money. So a few members of the DCCC, Keith Baraka, Mary Jung, who's also a realtor lobbyist, fun fact, Zoe Dunning, they all get several thousand dollars from a group called San Francisco Democrats United for Progress. Well, then you have to follow San Francisco Democrats United for Progress. They're getting $30,000 from the San Francisco Association of Realtors. But no one wants to say, I took thousands of dollars from the realtors, because politically, they block Ellis Act reform in the state. They block all sorts of protections for renters. The realtors are politically opposed to most renter protections. So to say you took money for them can be quite politically toxic. So you run it through all these little committees, and they go from committee to committee to committee to committee, and then finally to the candidate.
And what was that committee called?
This one is a San Francisco Democrats United for Progress.
Okay, so then you also have another one, Progress San Francisco.
Progress San Francisco.
And you report that Facebook contributed $50,000. Kevin York Systrom, CEO of Instagram, contributed $30,000. Evan Williams, CEO of Medium, $50,000. Google, $50,000.
Right, because you know when a reporter, when a reporter at the state level or something like that looks at it, they go, oh, they just donated to something called Progress San Francisco. Sounds very benign. Great, fantastic. And if you put that in a media report, you know, you have to really get into the weeds to explain to people how that money then goes. And, you know, some reporters aren't interested in talking about that kind of level of getting in the weeds. But as soon as that money goes into Progress San Francisco, all of a sudden we see that money go to all these DCCC candidates. Another thing to note is that some of these DCCC candidates are also sitting city supervisors,
right,
or running for the supervisor's seat. So we've got a race right now between Joshua Arce, Hillary Ronan, and Edwin Lindo, one of the hunger strikers from the Frisco Five, who are all running for the District 5 supervisor seat in San Francisco. That's the Mission District, Bernal Heights. These are people who are going to influence the housing development there, who are going to influence what happens with the police there, a place where Alex Nieto was shot and killed. This is a seat important for San Franciscans who care about the future of development, who care about the future of police in those neighborhoods. And so these three people running, one of them, Joshua Arce, is also running for DCCC. Now, when he's running for city supervisor, Josh Arce can't take any more than $500 per person. That's the contribution limit. But because he's also running for the Democratic Party board, the DCCC, he can take a big chunk of $35,000 from his friends at the labor union. Or he's taken more than $70,000 from them. He's taken lots of money in huge chunks that he would not otherwise be able to take on it running for supervisor. And many other supervisors who are running, both on the progressive and moderate side, are doing this. But in this particular race for the Mission District, he's the only candidate taking DCCC money.
Joe Fitzgerald Rodriguez is a political columnist for the San Francisco Examiner's On Guard, and he has been following money in politics. And now I would like to welcome Lee Feng to the show, Fong. Sorry, Lee. I always make that mistake. Lee is an investigative journalist with The Intercept who also covers money and politics. Thanks for coming in, Lee.
Hey, Rose. Thanks for having me.
So you are sort of a new resident to San Francisco, and you closely follow money and politics. Are you familiar with the DCCC and how it works? Have you been following coverage of this?
I have not followed it in this instance, but I have heard of the DTRIP loophole, you know, in which you can raise unlimited money and kind of circumvent the regular municipal campaign finance limits. I haven't followed any effort to close it. I'd like to know a little bit more about it. Is there any push to kind of reform this?
Yeah, there was within the DCCC, there was a push to push actually sitting supervisors and other officials off the rolls and to just make them members anyways. But then it came under some contention for some perhaps in the weeds reasons I might not go too deep into. And then later on, when that came under fire, the moderate member who suggested that, Alex Rosenthal, said, you know what? If I get elected and I retain my seat, I will introduce campaign finance reform into that, to her credit, even though she did take quite a bit of this Airbnb money and other tech money through this loophole.
Stephen just wrote in with a question. He said, I heard Willie Brown say in a recent interview that the key to the DCCC is that it can raise and share near unrestricted amounts of money. That is, it has fewer restrictions on limits for donations. And that's what you were just talking about.
Oh, totally. And another thing to note with that and its power in these local elections, these district supervisor elections, if you're running for supervisor of the Marina and Laurel Heights areas, or you're running for supervisor like Peskin did of Chinatown and also North Beach and the Hill, is TV ads don't help you as much. Buying television and radio ads really don't help you because you're targeting those neighborhoods when you're running for the supervisor seat. So the most effective ways you can campaign in these elections, because they're only decided by the neighborhoods, is actually knocking on doors and mailers.
Right. And I've been inundated.
Inundated with mailers.
Completely inundated.
And that's why you're inundated, because radio is useless and TV is useless for them as far as this goes.
It almost feels like a presidential election. I mean, that's how many mailers
we're getting. There's so much money in this. And it's so funny because no one knows who they are, but what they do will actually end up being important. And not only that, but those mailers, then later on, they will send mailers on behalf of other candidates. So come this November, when we've got all these people running for the seat, supervisor seat for the Mission and Bernal Heights and all that, right? They're going to get mailers on their behalf. Whoever is endorsed by the DCCC will send mailers on their behalf. And think about it. If you're a supervisor running for that seat, you don't have a lot of money to send out mailers because you have these contribution limits. But if the DCCC endorses you, well, by golly, they're going to take all sorts of money and send all sorts of mailers with your face all over it.
All right. So the big question is, how are you keeping up with this? Where are you going for news about this? Do you feel like the media are giving you the information that you need to figure out who are these candidates? And also, what's the importance of the DCCC? I don't remember it getting as much attention in the past, at least when it comes to money. We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And I want to repeat this throughout the show because we've been trying so hard to get this information out. If you are a no-party preference voter and you vote by mail and you have not requested a Democratic ballot and you want to vote for a Dem, you can also vote for a Libertarian, not Republican. You've got to go vote in person and request a Democratic ballot, or you will not be able to vote for president. And that is already happening in huge numbers. I highly suggest voting early because I'm afraid they're going to run out of ballots on Tuesday. So you've got about, what, 3 or 4 days before Tuesday. You can vote over the weekend at City Hall.
Yeah.
So go in early just to make sure you're not going to be angry about not voting for president, because this is already happening. Again, if you're no party preference, I highly suggest going in to vote early and asking for a Democratic ballot. You can also vote Libertarian. You're not allowed to vote for a Republican. I'm going to repeat that a few times. It's just not getting much attention. So if you have any questions about that, have you seen this covered in the media? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. All right, one more. The Committee to Expand the Middle Class. Airbnb contributed $20,000, and Mayor Ed Lee, backer, and billionaire tech investor Ron Conway donated $25,000.
Oh, yeah. Ron Conway. Oh, man. Ron Conway. So I love calling him every time I'm about to. So wait, some background on Ron Conway. So Ron Conway is an angel investor. He backed Airbnb. He backed Twitter. He backed so many multi-billion-dollar tech companies. And when you're a tech company and you want to talk to City Hall, you go to Ron Conway. He is known as the godfather of Silicon Valley. He's the guy you go to. And he talks to Mayor Ed Lee. He and Mayor Ed Lee are quite chummy. They get along quite well. It's widely said, though no one has been able to confirm this, that it was Ron Conway who ran Aaron Peskin's who was behind running Aaron Peskin's opponent, Julie Christensen, in North Beach for that District 3 election last year. You know, Ron Conway has a lot of influence for tech in San Francisco. And when we're talking about what one individual has more political influence with his money than anyone else in San Francisco, it is Ron Conway. So he donated quite a bit to these races. But there's also an as of yet unconfirmed but kind of floating around there in City Hall idea that Ron Conway is the one who rallied Facebook and Google and all these other folks and Instagram and Yahoo. And Yahoo wasn't in this round of funding, but they were in last year pretty heavily to fund all these candidates. I mean, think about it. What does Google care about the DCCC? What does Facebook care about the DCCC? So many people have not even heard of the group. Do you think these giant tech corporations have is kind of absurd. So the only person who's most logically the one rallying all that is Ron Conway. So every time I write about him, I give him a call. And every time I call him to ask him questions about his money, he goes, "Oh, I'm very busy right now, Joel. I'm very sorry. I got to go into a meeting. I'm right about to go into a meeting. I'm quite sorry." But, you know, you give him the chance to talk.
But he answers. Let's take a caller before we go to break. Let's hear from Sarah in San Francisco. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. I'm not politically involved particularly, but I think everybody in San Francisco has heard about the DCCC. I mean, I don't think it's new news. I think the fact that these two factions, the sort of Tom Amiano, Aaron Peskin side, and the Scott Wiener, Mayor Lee side, are running against each other is news. But the DCCC, I think everybody knows about it. What I love about this discussion is that you're revealing who's behind these various blandly named groups, because that's new to me. That's news. But the DCCC, I think, if you've lived in San Francisco for 10 minutes, you know about it, even if you're not politically active. So that, to me, is not the story.
All right.
Anyway,
that's
my opinion.
Well, thank you. I know a lot of people who don't know much about the DCCC at all, and they also didn't know that they had to be a registered Democrat in order to vote for the DCCC. They couldn't be no party preference.
Right. And one interesting point to note about that is, you know, she notes that, you know, if you've lived in San Francisco for 10 minutes, there are a lot of people who haven't lived in San Francisco who have lived in San Francisco for about 10 minutes and just kind of got here, new, whether, you know, sitting right here with us is new, or folks who are in tech and are new for jobs and just registered as Democrats. And if you just registered as a Democrat or as no party preference you might need to know about this.
Right. Okay, so Lee, you have been reporting on these groups with these names like Let's Help the Middle Class for many years at the national level, and now we're seeing this trickling down to the local level, which speaks to the importance of journalists really covering this. And before you arrived, Joe said, when was it when we had 20 reporters at City Hall?
Oh, yeah, like, you know, at least a decade ago.
Okay, so more. Not that long ago, 10 years ago, 20 reporters. Now there's four, sometimes only two.
Yeah, I mean, this is the world that we live in. In campaign finance terms, California allowed corporate donations a while ago, and now that's kind of become the status quo for every election all over the country. We focus a little bit more on our federal elections, but this is trickling down to the state and local level. And when you have when you detether campaign donations from a human being with a name and a social security number, then anything's possible. Because what is a corporation? It's a legal fiction, right? It's an LLC. It's a campaign committee. It's a nonprofit corporation. Whatever it is, it's something chartered by the state that where it's very easy to obfuscate where the money's actually coming from. So if you do want to conceal the source a campaign donation or an independent expenditure, when you have a system that allows corporate money, it becomes almost impossible to truly track the source of the money. So even if it comes, even if you can go peel back the layers of the onion and find, you know, a corporation that you recognize after you go through, you know, 60 plus association, Americans for Job Security, you know, U.S. Chamber, whatever. Still, you know, it's like, okay, well, this company, this who's the individual involved in this company? If you know, for the San Francisco elections, you know, why is Facebook donating? They don't even really need to tell you because it's a gigantic company and you have to go through a PR person who's trained not to talk to you.
All right. So what happens if you call up Facebook and you say, why is Facebook giving money to these organizations? What happens?
Well, I don't know about Facebook in this circumstance, but, you know, in general, yeah. they don't talk, or they say that they're involved in the public policy process or some kind of euphemism that has no meaning, you know. So it becomes very difficult. And then, you know, oftentimes you can't even track it back to a company that people recognize. You know, there's kind of these dead ends of LLCs that were created in Delaware or Utah that, you know, they might have a registered agent that's a lawyer that's also the registered agent for 4,000 other companies. It doesn't really tell you much information.
Yeah, like one interesting one is Stephen Kay. Stephen Kay is an attorney for Willie Brown, longtime Brown ally. Also, interestingly, I hear, argues and negotiates the contracts for Matiran Ross at the Chronicle. It's Matiran Ross's bridge to Willie. Stephen Kay, you know, donated $20,000 to Sophie Maxwell for DCCC and $2,500 to Norman Yee for DCCC. I mean, they're both on the reform slate, which is run by the progressives. But, you know, it's like, you know, where did that $20,000 come from? Is that really from Stephen Kay? Is that Willie Brown giving it to Stephen Kay to give it to Sophie because Willie Brown wants Sophie to win? Or who knows? We have no way to know.
We've got a bunch of emails on the DCCC here. Mark writes in a town where everyone's a Democrat, but there's a sharp division within the local party, getting the official Dem endorsement matters. If Conway folks control DCCC, you get different endorsements than if Tom Amiano controls it. And then we have an email from Chezza. It's important to stress, RE, this ballot, the reform candidates are the true progressives, and the progressive candidates are those against rent control, pro-developers, realtors, et cetera. This is very confusing.
Well, the reason it's confusing is because the moderates love to use the word progressive as much as they can to confuse voters who may not want to parse through all this stuff. So the moderates who take all the realtor money in the DCCC have named themselves the Progress Slate. So when you see the Progress Slate, know that that's the moderates who are backed by the realtors, who are trying to help Mary Jung, who is a realtor lobbyist who lobbies Ed Lee, keep her job as a Democratic Party chair. And then the progressives have the reform slate. I know, it's confusing, right? I love it. Say progress three times fast.
All right.
Language gets butchered in an election.
Yeah. Right, we're going to take a quick break. Today we're talking about coverage of money in politics. Joe Fitzgerald Rodriguez is a columnist and reporter with the San Francisco Examiner, and Lee Fong is an investigative reporter with The Intercept. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KLW, local public radio. If you have a perspective that you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11, it's Inflection Point. Stay with us.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we're going to talk about guaranteed basic income. This weekend, Switzerland residents are voting on providing everyone in the country the equivalent of $2,500 a month. And you can bet people around the world are watching this because there's no strings attached. Here in the United States, the idea has become popular with both tech and labor leaders. So how politically and economically feasible is a guaranteed basic income in the United States? And what questions do you have about it? That's on Monday. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our media roundtable, and a couple days before the primary, we are talking about money in politics. We're talking about how it's covered. Joe Fitzgerald Rodriguez is a political columnist for the San Francisco Examiner's On Guard, and Lee Fong is an investigative journalist with The Intercept. I want to talk just quickly again about what's happening with ballots in California. I knew this was going to happen, and this is why I brought it up so many times over the past 2 months. So KCRA is reporting that Political Data has done an exit poll of independent vote-by-mail voters. 40% said they wanted to vote for a Democratic presidential candidate, but only 15% requested a Democratic ballot. So this means that so many people in California are not voting for president because they didn't know that they had to request a Democratic ballot. I called the Secretary of State's office 2 months ago and said, are you going to do a public outreach campaign? And they said, why? I said, it's so confusing. I have not really seen this covered as much as I think it should in the media. Have you at all, Lee, in the local state media?
I've just seen it a little bit, not that much.
Joe? I mean, this is information that voters really need. So the question is the onus on the voter to do all this reading, or should the media inform them?
Well, it's definitely the media's responsibility. I mean, this is the central function of democracy, how to vote. And, yeah, government could do better.
Yeah, I mean, I was shocked. I just in a somewhat related story, you know, just locally in San Francisco, you know, 1,400 ballots for no-party preference voters who requested Democratic ballots did not receive those Democratic ballots and received no-party preference. And especially, and if we're not to go back to the DCCC, but, you know, that election, those races are decided by as few as 40 votes. 50 votes, and I'm serious, 40, 50 votes. When you lose 1,400 ballots or they don't get the Democratic slate, that's huge.
Right, and so for people who don't live in San Francisco, you cannot vote in the DCCC race if you're a Green, for example, or a no-party preference voter.
Right.
You had to change your registration.
Right. Well, and that also affects the primary for presidential.
Right.
Right.
Okay, so you reported that 1,400 ballots of the wrong affiliation were sent out. Mm-hmm. What did the San Francisco Department of Elections do about this, and how did you learn about it?
Yeah, I learned about it from readers who sent me in a letter that they received from the Department of Elections that notified them of this and said, hey, we're really sorry. Sorry, we're going to get you a replacement ballot as fast as we can. You know, some people got most people got replacement ballots by now, but it was 2 weeks, 3 weeks later. And the first ballot that they sent in, Department of Elections told me, is going to be counted. So if you're a voter, you got a no-party preference ballot, and you voted, you sent it in, are you really going to send in that second? Do you care enough to send in that second
ballot? Well, what happens if you send in a second ballot?
If you send in the second ballot, the first one is voided. But is everything going to go smoothly with that? They're going to have to do that by hand. Like, they're now tallying all this stuff, and they're going through these votes and the no-party preference registrations manually. So are they going to go through all this manually and find everyone and contact everyone? I'm not entirely sure how smooth that's going to go.
That's incredible. You know, if you're if there's a BART delay or bridge delay, the media is there to tell you. You know, like the media is like the television, radio, print. There's a lot of reminders. But some of those kind of essential functions, like electing who governs us, not as much alert, you know?
and Lee, you know about the things that – and we all know what things drive media to write what they're going to write or broadcast what they're going to broadcast. I mean, would you guys agree that, you know, sometimes it's the it's the idea of sensationalism and like what, and I hate to say it because it's such an old truism, but the idea that, you know, if it bleeds, it leads. But, you know, if the BART stops or a bridge is blocked, we're going to write about it because there are going to be eyeballs, and then some people don't want to write about it because who's going to click on that story about 1,400 ballots being lost?
Oh, sure. And it's a little bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy because there isn't as much outrage about this. Because it's confusing, people don't speak up. There isn't like a quick, you know, social media posting or picture that can kind of fuel some media coverage. So, you know, there's an obvious dynamic here that makes it a little bit different than an infrastructure problem or BART delay. But in terms of importance, yeah, the election is a little bit more important.
Well, the president of the Political Data, this group that did this exit poll that found 40% of voters wanted to vote for a Democrat, but only 15% asked for the ballot, says it's a black eye for our election process for this to happen. They also found that of those voters, 58% they would have voted for Bernie Sanders, 37% said they would have voted for Hillary Clinton. So, I mean, we're going to have an election where a lot of people are not voting for president in California.
You know, one thing that's kind of interesting here, going back to the D-Trip conversation,
yeah.
I noticed a lot of those names that Joe was talking about were media publishers, really. I mean, Facebook's becoming a news publisher. Medium is supposedly a media company that's supposed to help demystify the world around us. But they're using these really confusing ways to funnel money into the election. And you know what? They're media companies. They could actually explain some of these voting problems. I don't think that – has Facebook sent out an alert about how to vote in California?
Could you imagine?
Yeah, right?
Maybe they don't want higher turnout. I don't know.
You, every day we get – it's Veterans Day today. It's different day today. Tell your friend happy birthday. And again, I just want to make sure and get this information out. No party preference voter. If you have your ballot and there's not a Democratic name on it, if you want to vote for a Dem or a Libertarian for president, you can go vote in person and ask for a crossover ballot. By law, they have to give you one. But I suggest you do it early because I think they're going to run out on Election Day because so many people don't have this information. I'm hoping this is going to get more information over the weekend.
You know, going back to the conversation about whether or not you can, you know, how you can track and how can you explain, does Facebook explain, do we explain how these things happen? I mean, the political process itself tries to muddy the waters as much as possible, which makes it tougher for us to explain things. The tougher it is for us to explain things, more people's eyes glaze over. Here's one interesting example, I think. So Jane Kim and Scott Wiener are running a Senate race here in San Francisco for the state Senate, right?
Right.
They're two San Francisco supervisors. They're going toe-to-toe. On some things they agree, but there are some things that they widely disagree about, transportation, homelessness, this and that. Jane Kim sent out an email, or her campaign sent out an email, trying to allege that Scott Wiener took money from Chevron and Fox News and all this stuff, right? But it's one of those kind of really muddy things because of how our campaign finance works. So Chevron made a donation of $300,000 to, I believe, Californians for Jobs and a Strong Economy. And they made a donation to another group. I think – is this Equality California, right? A political action committee for that fights for LGBT groups and LGBT rights. And then they bought – ad time for Scott Wiener. I'm sorry. Yes, Equality California has bought ad time. See, it's so muddied. Bought ad time for Scott Wiener on TV for $100,000. So because Scott Wiener took money from Equality California, that took money then in turn from a group that took money from Chevron, does that mean Scott Wiener took money from Chevron? Maybe. I don't know. I don't know what that means. It's like four entities removed. It very well could be.
Well,
or very well could not be.
So to add to that, the same thing is happening at the state level.
Mm-hmm.
And the LA Times has been doing really good coverage on this. They found that powerful interest groups in California have spent $24 million on legislative races. And in some cases, politicians do not even know that they're being featured in commercials. So I just want to read this lead. Patrick McGreevy and Chris McGarian, want to give them kudos for this great piece. Cecilia Aguiar Curry, a Democratic Assembly candidate from the small Northern California farming town of Winters, got a surprise when she bumped into a friend at a local coffee shop. A friend said, "Oh, I saw your commercial." And she said, "You're mistaken. I don't have a commercial." But in fact, there is a commercial because outside groups have spent more than $1.7 million to support her. Some of the money is coming from oil and tobacco companies, organizations whose cash she said she doesn't want in her personal campaign account, but they're running commercials in favor of her.
Right, right, right.
So thinking that these politicians are spending the money, but they're not, and they don't even know the commercials are airing.
Sure.
That's good that, I mean, look, at the end of the day, they're not supposed to know. If it's an independent expenditure by law, they're not allowed to coordinate. So it's kind of refreshing that a candidate in this circumstance didn't know. But in most cases, the supposedly independent money is actually well coordinated with the candidate, and they know exactly what's going on. So that's a refreshing anecdote, though. That she actually didn't know.
That's I mean, there's a candidate actually who there's a DCCC candidate who's also a sitting city supervisor, Mark Farrell. We actually grew up in the same neighborhood in San Francisco, and Mark Farrell was found in violation of certain ethics laws for coordinating with his independent expenditure committee. He's fighting that. He's actually suing San Francisco's ethics commission. He's a sitting supervisor suing a city agency over this supposed alleged ethics violation. It's amazing. And because they allege that he coordinated with his IE. And when you think about it, these like deep-pocketed multimillionaires gave $100,000 to someone working for his IE that he's worked with before. Like, does this campaign staffer really have the ability to raise that from a multimillionaire? Or like, does Mark go, hey, can you help me out? Like, I mean, that's the question, right?
Well, the other question is who's controlling the message at the end of the day? Because in this New York LA Times piece, Bob Stern, the attorney who helped write California's campaign finance rules, says the candidate is not controlling the message. It's special interests trying to control the race and buy their way into the legislature.
Yeah. I mean, in some cases, you know, who writes the ad is interesting because if that's a way you can kind of figure out if there might be coordination because they share campaign consultants, they share election lawyers, or, you know, these people will migrate between group and group, and it's like, okay, well, who knows? There's no, you know, smoking gun email of, you know, coordination, but it's clear that there's some crossover, right? So, you know, we don't know, but at the end of the day, the bigger kind of dynamic here is that we still have campaign finance contribution caps for giving directly to candidates for a lot of elections, San Francisco to the federal level. But these days it's meaningless because the big money that actually can decide a race goes into the IEs so that they have overwhelming amounts of influence.
I also wanted to give kudos to Cal Matters. They've got a piece, Oil Money Flows for Black and Latino Democrats. It's by Laurel Rosenhall. She writes, it's not often that interest groups call out public officials by their race, but as environmentalists evaluated state lawmakers' voting records last year, that's exactly what they did. The California Environmental Justice Alliance wrote in its scorecard that Black and Latino Democrats must do better to buck the interests of the petroleum industry and help the communities they represent. The group says we can't sit by on the sidelines as communities of color are used as a wedge for the interest of lobbying groups. The report followed a bruising fight that split the Democrats over a proposal to slash vehicles' petroleum use to slow global warming. And oil companies are pouring millions into contests across the race, across the state. The Dems they most visibly support happen to be Black and Latino.
Yeah, this isn't a new dynamic. This is happening all over the country. And it's not just, of course, oil money. The oil money has been a very salient example. For special interest groups like Wall Street, telecom in particular, telecom has been very good at this. You know, these big money interests have gone in and bought certain constituency groups within the Democratic Party. When I mean bought, I mean not everyone is taking the money, but they go in and they find surrogate third-party groups, sometimes, you know, Urban League or local chapters of the NAACP that they will fund. They will find candidates who are otherwise very strong on progressive issues, voting rights, maybe LGBT issues, but on kind of more esoteric areas where, you know, they think they can buy influence on maybe some climate change regulations or financial rules. They've done a very good job of winning influence within these constituent groups.
And on that same note, you know, tech has gotten very good at rallying these groups because often they operate through an app and they have the email addresses of the people who use their platform. Uber, for instance, when Uber wants to counter a law in a particular city, they really don't like a position a city council member has taken. They have 10 to 30,000 drivers who use their app. They can send an email. Hey, driver, do you like this change that's happening? Do you agree with this? We think it's going to hurt you and your ability to make money. Why don't you turn out and come and speak against this law? If you send that email to 30,000 Uber drivers, you're going to get some percentage of them, and that's going to be a huge showing. It drives news. It pressures politicians. It makes them feel it. Airbnb is probably a great example of this because in their success in overturning Proposition F in San Francisco, which would have added further regulations and restrictions to who could use Airbnb and when and how and under what circumstances, Airbnb turned out a lot of its users in droves. And when they were successful in doing this and spending like northward of like $8 million, was it northward of 10? I can't quite remember. But in spending all this money and turning out all these people, then they said quite publicly, this is a great model for shaping democracy. We're going to replicate it throughout the country. So what started here in San Francisco as a – I mean, it's been used by other companies in different ways. But what started here in San Francisco from Airbnb is now being replicated in other cities across the country as they fight these new regulations. It's fascinating to see the kind of I don't know if it's like the commodification or the businessification of Democratic groups. There's one Democratic club. So every city has all these smaller Democratic clubs, right? You might have the Richmond Democratic Club. You might have the My Neighborhood Democratic Club. Now there is a Home Sharers Democratic Club for people who use Airbnb's platform. And the home sharers are bolstered by lots of Airbnb money. And then they are like, we're regular voters and we care about our home sharing platform. And then they go argue in little meetings like the DCCC.
I mean, it's the same thing that, you know, special interest groups have always done. So it's just kind of hypercharged in this new kind of deregulated campaign finance world. But a lot of this goes on. Looking throughout the 20th century, special interest groups, oil, steel, whatever, would buy into the culture wars. They would kind of fund, you know, white interest groups, for lack of a better term, Irish American culture groups, to kind of buy off a constituency where they could, you know, they don't want to argue as the oil or steel industry. They want to argue as supporting, you know, the Irish American cause or whatever. So we're just seeing like the progression of that. Now that America is becoming a majority minority country, and there are new kind of catchy terms in the culture wars, being progressive is now a good thing, you know, being you know, standing for civil rights or whatever is a good thing. That's why you see tech and oil money going in and doing everything they can to either create fake progressive groups or going into longstanding progressive groups or civil rights groups for that matter, and then funneling lots of money so they can get an edge in these legislative debates.
Yeah, that's very true. What's different is the amount with which they can do it, which tech can do it.
Joe Fitzgerald Rodriguez is a columnist with The Examiner, and Lee Fong is an independent investigative journalist with The Intercept. And Bruce Brugman, former editor and publisher of the San Francisco Bay Guardian, called, couldn't stand the line. He wanted to say that if you are confused about anything that's on the ballot, go to the Guardian's website to find their slate. They've got descriptions. They've got endorsements. The Green Party has that. The League of Pissed Off Voters has that. If you're in the East Bay Express has it. If you just search Slate 2016 California Primary, and you'll find a lot of information.
I love Bruce.
Yeah. All right. Sorry, but we couldn't take you, Bruce. Thanks for calling in. Let's see. I have an email about the election. Rob writes in, my father-in-law wanted to vote for Bernie but didn't request a Dem ballot. He's an absentee voter and already mailed his ballot. He assumes he's SOL as far as voting for Bernie. Is he right? Unfortunately, yes. Mm. Another one.
Yeah.
Well, we're trying to get the word out here. Again, if you're a no party preference voter, you need to go vote in person. Do not mail it in or you can't vote for president. And by law, you have to get a crossover ballot. But you should vote early because I think on election day they're going to run out of ballots.
Very possible.
Let's see. I wanted to ask you quickly, Lee, before we end. You've been reporting on the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia and the lobbyists that are pouring money into that.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of a proxy battle for the Democratic primary that's gone on over the last year. You know, we've seen another insurgent candidate, Bernie Sanders, going up against Hillary Clinton. And the Democratic Party, as many Bernie supporters have alleged for a very long time, are the Democratic Party's very closely held by Hillary Clinton's allies. You know, the DNC and Hillary Clinton campaign share election lawyers, share consultants. There's been transfers of money from the DNC to Hillary Clinton's super PACs. The DNC chairwoman, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, was a former co-chairman of Hillary Clinton's election campaign in 2008. So, you know, this has not been a very kind of – this has been actually a very nasty fight. But going into the convention, we're seeing actually kind of an actual policy difference too in the sense that President Barack Obama, when he became the nominee, he instituted all these ethics reforms for the DNC and for the Democratic Party. Debbie Wasserman Schultz has quietly repealed all of them, allowing lobbyists, registered lobbyist money to flow into the party, into the convention, that they're putting lobbyists in charge of certain aspects of the convention, and that the host committee hosting the convention in Philadelphia is filled with lobbyists, notably some of them and business executives, big fundraisers for the Republican Party. So, you know, we pointed out some of this at The Intercept, but we've seen a few new wrinkles of this in the policy committee fight. I don't know if you want to cut in here.
Yeah, we have about a minute. Go ahead.
Oh, and then so I think the next kind of stage in this political fight is the policy committee that sets the official platform of the Democratic Party. Bernie got some representatives in there. Debbie Wasserman Schultz picked some, and Hillary Clinton's campaign picked several. As we noted, the DNC and the Hillary Clinton campaign, kind of in a symbolic gesture, at least in, from my perspective, appointed actual lobbyists and people from the lobbying industry onto this platform committee alongside some kind of longstanding politicians.
Well, we're going to continue following this next week. We didn't even have time to talk about the presidential candidates in California. I mean, Bernie Sanders is going to cities in California I've never even heard of. I can't even find them on a map. I mean, he's going to Cloverdale tonight, right? It's about 85 miles north of San Francisco, and bringing out 10, 20,000 people. In Oakland, it was about 25,000 people.
Yeah, it's been an amazing turnout, and people have been really feeling the energy.
So we will definitely cover that next week. The primary is on Tuesday. I hope everybody's able to vote. Again, if you're no party preference, try to vote early. Go in person. If you want to vote for a Dem, you can also vote for a Libertarian, not a Republican. And you have to request a crossover ballot or you will not be able to vote for president. People are handing in their ballots and they're not voting for president. So please spread the word about that. Joe Fitzgerald Rodriguez is a political columnist with the SF Examiner. And Lee Fong is an investigative journalist with The Intercept. Thank you both for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Your Call, what if everyone was guaranteed a basic income? Switzerland residents are voting on providing everyone in the country the equivalent of $25,000 a month with no strings attached. Here in the U.S., the idea has become popular with both tech and labor leaders. Supporters say it would alleviate poverty and spark entrepreneurship. So how politically and economically feasible is a guaranteed basic income in the U.S.? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.